Test 7. Part 1. You will hear three different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B, or C which fits best according to what you hear. There are two questions for each extract. Extract 1.
I think it was Mark Twain who said something like, "When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have the old fellow around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years." It's a priceless quotation, I think, because it hits the nail right on the head. When we're teenagers, we think we know everything. We're sure the world is wrong and we're right. We have these ideals about how to live, about life. And for us, our parents are stuck in a rut, living a life we would never live in a million years. Then you get older and get a job, and suddenly you find you don't want to go out all the time, that your evenings and weekends are taken up with sorting out the house or fixing something or washing and ironing and cooking. And it's pleasant, after all, to watch TV for the evening. And there is an alternative, throwing it all away and hitting the road or whatever, but it's not something that appeals all that much anymore. I think it was Mark Twain who said something like, "When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have the old fellow around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years." It's a priceless quotation, I think, because it hits the nail right on the head. When we're teenagers, we think we know everything. We're sure the world is wrong and we're right. We have these ideals about how to live, about life. And for us, our parents are stuck in a rut, living a life we would never live in a million years. Then you get older and get a job, and suddenly you find you don't want to go out all the time, that your evenings and weekends are taken up with sorting out the house or fixing something or washing and ironing and cooking. And it's pleasant, after all, to watch TV for the evening. And there is an alternative, throwing it all away and hitting the road or whatever, but it's not something that appeals all that much anymore.
Extract 2.
"I'll never understand them if I live to be 100, I swear. And I don't know if you're meant to. I mean, they're meant to be individuals, aren't they? But you do expect there to be one or two basic rules to follow. Or that after the first, things would get easier. We've got 4 now. That's the lot. There's no way we could afford any more. But each one has had their own quirks and peculiarities. Not all bad, mind you. I'm crazy about them and wouldn't want to change them for the world. But they can drive you crazy too. I suppose when they leave, I'll miss them like mad. But it'd be nice to have a week off to spend with my wife now and again in the meantime. The eldest is getting to that age where they don't listen to a word you say. The youngest is in the terrible twos. All I'm saying is if you've got some book telling you how to bring them up, chuck it in the bin. It'll be no use to you." "I'll never understand them if I live to be 100, I swear. And I don't know if you're meant to. I mean, they're meant to be individuals, aren't they? But you do expect there to be one or two basic rules to follow. Or that after the first, things would get easier. We've got 4 now. That's the lot. There's no way we could afford any more. But each one has had their own quirks and peculiarities. Not all bad, mind you. I'm crazy about them and wouldn't want to change them for the world. But they can drive you crazy too. I suppose when they leave, I'll miss them like mad. But it'd be nice to have a week off to spend with my wife now and again in the meantime. The eldest is getting to that age where they don't listen to a word you say. The youngest is in the terrible twos. All I'm saying is if you've got some book telling you how to bring them up, chuck it in the bin. It'll be no use to you."
Extract
3.
Storms make me nervous.
I can tell. You've been pacing up and down like a clockwork soldier since you got here.
It's not just that, you know. This merger will either sink or swim over the next 24 hours, and my career along with it. Still, the thunder doesn't help.
Would you like a coffee or a tea?
A tea would be nice. A coffee now would just make me twice as bad. And when Morris comes, I'll be shaking like a leaf.
Is he definitely on his way?
Stuck in traffic, he said.
I'll go and set up meeting room 1. Get the heating on in there.
Don't worry, Francis. It's just the two of us. So we might as well do it in here, where all the files are. If you don't mind setting things up on the table by the couch, you can get off home.
I'm not going anywhere till the rain stops.
Storms make me nervous.
I can tell. You've been pacing up and down like a clockwork soldier since you got here.
It's not just that, you know. This merger will either sink or swim over the next 24 hours, and my career along with it. Still, the thunder doesn't help.
Would you like a coffee or a tea?
A tea would be nice. A coffee now would just make me twice as bad. And when Morris comes, I'll be shaking like a leaf.
Is he definitely on his way?
Stuck in traffic, he said.
I'll go and set up meeting room 1. Get the heating on in there.
Don't worry, Francis. It's just the two of us. So we might as well do it in here, where all the files are. If you don't mind setting things up on the table by the couch, you can get off home.
I'm not going anywhere till the rain stops.
That's the end of part 1. Now turn to part 2. Part 2. You will hear a travel writer being interviewed about her trip to the Gobi Desert. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 2.
And why the Gobi Desert?
Well, I suppose I have to admit to a certain vanity. The Gobi is a desert of mystery, and as a travel writer, it is the unknown that has always attracted me. I visited the rosy red city of Petra, carved out of the desert rock in Jordan. I've been from the tip of Cape Horn to the northernmost piece of land on Earth, an island at the top of Greenland. Very few Europeans have been through the Gobi, only a handful since Marco Polo made his famous journey. So I knew it was the place for me.
What's the problem with the place? Apart from being a desert, of course, but that doesn't usually stop the intrepid traveller.
First of all, it's a desert, yes, but perhaps the most inhospitable one on Earth. It is the world's northernmost, which means in winter it is bitterly cold. It is high up and winds sweep across, blowing sand into dunes, or sand mountains, really, seeing as they rise up to 1,200 feet in the air. It is the area with the lowest population density in the world, outside of the Antarctic, of course.
And you went there voluntarily?
Believe it or not, yes! I wanted to make the journey Marco Polo might have made over 700 years ago, through a place he described in his book as full of spirits, a strange and dangerous land. I set off with a local guide from the lake of Lob Nor to the southwest of the desert, and we travelled into a world of desolate beauty and breathtaking contrasts. It was love at first sight for me.
Give me an example. It's something that's hard to see through such a forest of adjectives.
Well, first there's Badon Jaran on the Alashan Plateau, sometimes called the Miraculous Lakes in English. It's an area of huge dunes like the ones I described earlier, interspersed with lakes fed by underground springs. Because it's so hot during the day, the water tends to evaporate faster than it can fill up, so the mineral concentration is very high, attracting certain types of bacteria. So you have the blue of the water, the bright green bacteria, the red of the surrounding desert, At sunset, it's like nothing you've seen in your life. Then there's Karakoto.
What's that?
It's the ruins of an ancient city that flourished in the north of the Gobi until about the 14th century. It was a Mongol city, but that empire was on the wane and the Chinese Ming dynasty on the rise. The legend goes that the Chinese army was outside laying siege to the city, and the general ordered the soldiers to divert the city's water source, the Black River, so it no longer flowed by the city. Then they sat down and waited. When the thirst forced the Mongols to emerge and fight, they were slaughtered and the city left to turn to dust. Whether this story is true, the river did change course, and it is now a ghost city, the huge stone walls 12 feet thick, enclosing an area of about 1 million square feet.
That's quite a story. Is that the strongest memory for you?
The strongest impression I took away with me was about the people, because somehow some do manage to live and survive in this unforgiving climate. Many are Mongolians living the old way, bringing up goats and the like. They are very hospitable, and wherever you go, out comes the chair and the tea. Their faces are shaped by the desert. It's almost as if they're made of rock, with wrinkles like the deep scoring made in desert rock by the driving wind and sand.
And why the Gobi Desert?
Well, I suppose I have to admit to a certain vanity. The Gobi is a desert of mystery, and as a travel writer, it is the unknown that has always attracted me. I visited the rosy red city of Petra, carved out of the desert rock in Jordan. I've been from the tip of Cape Horn to the northernmost piece of land on Earth, an island at the top of Greenland. Very few Europeans have been through the Gobi, only a handful since Marco Polo made his famous journey. So I knew it was the place for me.
What's the problem with the place? Apart from being a desert, of course, but that doesn't usually stop the intrepid traveller.
First of all, it's a desert, yes, but perhaps the most inhospitable one on Earth. It is the world's northernmost, which means in winter it is bitterly cold. It is high up and winds sweep across, blowing sand into dunes, or sand mountains, really, seeing as they rise up to 1,200 feet in the air. It is the area with the lowest population density in the world, outside of the Antarctic, of course.
And you went there voluntarily?
Believe it or not, yes! I wanted to make the journey Marco Polo might have made over 700 years ago, through a place he described in his book as full of spirits, a strange and dangerous land. I set off with a local guide from the lake of Lob Nor to the southwest of the desert, and we travelled into a world of desolate beauty and breathtaking contrasts. It was love at first sight for me.
Give me an example. It's something that's hard to see through such a forest of adjectives.
Well, first there's Badon Jaran on the Alashan Plateau, sometimes called the Miraculous Lakes in English. It's an area of huge dunes like the ones I described earlier, interspersed with lakes fed by underground springs. Because it's so hot during the day, the water tends to evaporate faster than it can fill up, so the mineral concentration is very high, attracting certain types of bacteria. So you have the blue of the water, the bright green bacteria, the red of the surrounding desert. At sunset, it's like nothing you've seen in your life. Then there's Karakoto.
What's that?
It's the ruins of an ancient city that flourished in the north of the Gobi until about the 14th century. It was a Mongol city, but that empire was on the wane and the Chinese Ming dynasty on the rise. The legend goes that the Chinese army was outside laying siege to the city, and the general ordered the soldiers to divert the city's water source, the Black River, so it no longer flowed by the city. Then they sat down and waited. When the thirst forced the Mongols to emerge and fight, they were slaughtered and the city left to turn to dust. Whether this story is true, the river did change course, and it is now a ghost city, the huge stone walls 12 feet thick, enclosing an area of about 1 million square feet.
That's quite a story. Is that the strongest memory for you?
The strongest impression I took away with me was about the people, because somehow some do manage to live and survive in this unforgiving climate. Many are Mongolians living the old way, bringing up goats and the like. They are very hospitable, and wherever you go, out comes the chair and the tea. Their faces are shaped by the desert. It's almost as if they're made of rock, with wrinkles like the deep scoring made in desert rock by the driving wind and sand.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part 3. You will hear two literature students discussing a theory known as the intentional fallacy.
For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C, or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at Part 3.
So the intentional fallacy, as it is called, is the falsely held belief that it is what the artist intended to communicate that is important and should be sought in a book rather than the message the readers themselves get.
Well, generally, most readers know nothing about the author, so the point is a moot one for all but literature students like ourselves. But I think this focus on the lives of authors and how it inspired them, though interesting, has grown a little obsessive.
It's like, let's see what skeletons hang in their closet.
Well, it's a common enough kind of curiosity. The question is whether it helps in terms of trying to understand the work or just to understand the person.
For me, it's the latter. For one thing, a work of art should succeed or fail on its own merits. And secondly, which is connected, it doesn't really matter what was intended, but what is actually communicated. And so it is the readers who are the owners of the right of judgment. It would be better for the author to go to them and ask them, "What does my book mean?" rather than vice versa.
I'd like to see that. But many authors are so deeply involved in their own world anyway, they'd have a hard time coming out and being able to objectively criticize what they've produced. It'd be like saying to a mother who's just given birth, "What are the pros and cons of little Ronnie?"
Quite. Though authors, I've found, have a tendency to complain less about their work than any mother. Even if it keeps them awake all night long, they still don't complain.
I think this fallacy came about through a need to create a foundation for criticism again, to find some place where a solid meaning did exist. There's the perfectly valid point that every interpretation of a book is individual and impossible to contradict. But where does that leave the discipline? The critic is suddenly just one voice among a thousand others. And that's a little frightening, especially when it's your career, what you've devoted your life to.
Well, okay, up to a point. But it's a little bit defensive, don't you think? I mean, put 10 people in front of a picture of a duck, and on the whole, they'll agree it's a duck. Now, you can say it gets harder the more complex it gets, but I do believe we have a common basis to a certain extent.
We're not from different planets, after all. Cognitive science is coming up with more and more evidence that our bodies play a key role in our conceptualizing in how we see the world. The fact that we stand upright, have left-right symmetry, vision being our primary sense, all that.
And we shouldn't be so afraid of different interpretations anyway. I mean, surely the greatness of a work should lie in its richness. There's a certain way of thinking that fears this uncertainty, that wants to be able to say, this means this and nothing else.
End of discussion.
But why is it we love the Mona Lisa? Is it because we've finally understood what she's grinning about?
And since the expert is usually the one who knows all the angles, why should it be so destructive to their ego if someone comes up with something new once in a while?
There is also the danger that if that is the attitude you take, that the meaning is there and readers just need your guidance to get to it, what if one day you come up with a startling new way to look at it? I'm sure you're not going to brush it under the carpet, so it's a bit hypocritical. So the intentional fallacy, as it is called, is the falsely held belief that it is what the artist intended to communicate that is important and should be sought in a book rather than the message the readers themselves get.
Well, generally, most readers know nothing about the author, so the point is a moot one for all but literature students like ourselves. But I think this focus on the lives of authors and how it inspired them, though interesting, has grown a little obsessive.
It's like, let's see what skeletons hang in their closet.
Well, it's a common enough kind of curiosity. The question is whether it helps in terms of trying to understand the work or just to understand the person.
For me, it's the latter. For one thing, a work of art should succeed or fail on its own merits. And secondly, which is connected, it doesn't really matter what was intended, but what is actually communicated. And so it is the readers who are the owners of the right of judgment. It would be better for the author to go to them and ask them, what does my book mean, rather than vice versa.
I'd like to see that. But many authors are so deeply involved in their own world anyway, they'd have a hard time coming out and being able to objectively criticize what they've produced. It'd be like saying to a mother who's just given birth, what are the pros and cons of little Ronnie?
Quite. Though authors, I've found, have a tendency to complain less about their work than any mother. Even if it keeps them awake all night long, they still don't complain.
I think this fallacy came about through a need to create a foundation for criticism again, to find some place where a solid meaning did exist. There's the perfectly valid point that every interpretation of a book is individual and impossible to contradict. But where does that leave the discipline? The critic is suddenly just one voice among a thousand others. And that's a little frightening, especially when it's your career, what you've devoted your life to.
Well, okay, up to a point. But it's a little bit defensive, don't you think? I mean, put 10 people in front of a picture of a duck, and on the whole, they'll agree it's a duck. Now, you can say it gets harder the more complex it gets, but I do believe we have a common basis to a certain extent.
We're not from different planets, after all. Cognitive science is coming up with more and more evidence that our bodies play a key role in our conceptualizing in how we see the world. The fact that we stand upright, have left-right symmetry, vision being our primary sense, all that.
And we shouldn't be so afraid of different interpretations anyway. I mean, surely the greatness of a work should lie in its richness. There's a certain way of thinking that fears this uncertainty, that wants to be able to say this means this and nothing else.
End of discussion.
But why is it we love the Mona Lisa? Is it because we've finally understood what she's grinning about?
And since the expert is usually the one who knows all the angles, why should it be so destructive to their ego if someone comes up with something new once in a while?
There is also the danger that if that is the attitude you take, that the meaning is there and readers just need your guidance to get to it, what if one day you come up with a startling new way to look at it? I'm sure you're not going to brush it under the carpet, so it's a bit hypocritical.
That's the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. Part 4. Part 4 consists of 2 tasks. You'll hear 5 short extracts in which different people talk about an event they took part in. Look at task 1. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list A to H each speaker's reason for taking part in the event. Now look at task 2. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list A to H how each speaker felt after the event. While you listen, you must complete both tasks. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 4. Speaker 1.
My friends had been planning it for months, to enter the marathon while we were on holiday in Greece.
Not wanting to miss out, I decided to join them, and I'm really glad I did. Anyway, what struck me was the number of foreigners entering. They completely outnumbered the Greeks. Maybe the locals just weren't interested. And you know, as I was running, I felt like I was reliving a golden age in history, and I kept trying to visualize what the original run must have been like. When we crossed the finishing line, which was in the old stadium, everyone clapped and cheered us, even though we were way behind the winners. The atmosphere was amazing. It was a one-off, but an experience I'll never forget.
Speaker 2.
Well, I got roped into the tug-of-war competition after meeting the fathers of other children at the same school as my kids. It was all they talked of for days beforehand, and I soon got into the spirit of things. We boasted about how fit we were and how no one stood a chance against us. There weren't many people there at first, but the school field soon filled up. The event had been well advertised. We found ourselves up against a team of big, burly firemen who just grinned at each other when they saw how unfit we were. I had imagined how proud my sons would be to see me win, but instead, they both walked away in disgust when our team fell over in the mud. At least I was able to see the funny side of things.
Speaker 3.
It was an awful experience. For starters, I would have expected the organisers to have at least heated the pool. It was like diving into the Arctic Ocean. It was my first swimming club competition, and definitely my last. No seats had been provided for the spectators, who were everywhere, even at the side of the pool, and there were so many competitors that we had trouble trying to find somewhere to change into our costumes. Once the races were over, some of the more competitive swimmers started arguing with the judges about finishing times. Fortunately, the judges paid no attention to them. But just the thought of those people telling lies to win a competition made me see red and basically spoilt everything for me. And to think I'd only entered the competition for the hell of it. So much for sportsmanship.
Speaker 4.
I love bowling, so I thought I could get in lots of practice by going to the all-night bowling alley. There were all sorts of people there, and the evening started really well. The lanes were well polished, which made it easier to do tricks like using spin. It was a great chance to hone my skills. I'd heard that they usually turned off the main lights at midnight and bowled in lanes lit by fairy lights. This time, though, it didn't happen, which was a bit of a letdown. Instead, all these professionals came out and gave a demonstration of how to get strike after strike. Although impressive to watch, it kind of put a damper on my plans.
Speaker 5.
I only did it because my brothers bet that I wouldn't. The training was quite expensive, so I didn't want to back out even though I was terrified. Anyway, I found myself on a small plane, which was quite amazing in itself, as I have a fear of heights. The instructor lined us up, and out we sprang one by one. Though I didn't admit it to my brothers, I spent the next 20 minutes with my eyes tightly shut, praying to every god in the universe. I was petrified. As soon as my feet touched the ground, I bent down and kissed it over and over again. Of course, my brothers now think I'm incredibly brave, which I feel a bit bad about. It's like I'm pretending to be something I'm not. Maybe I should just own up.
Speaker 1.
My friends had been planning it for months, to enter the marathon while we were on holiday in Greece. Not wanting to miss out, I decided to join them, and I'm really glad I did. Anyway, what struck me was the number of foreigners entering. They completely outnumbered the Greeks. Maybe the locals just weren't interested. And you know, as I was running, I felt like I was reliving a golden age in history, and I kept trying to visualize what the original run must have been like. When we crossed the finishing line, which was in the old stadium, everyone clapped and cheered us, even though we were way behind the winners. The atmosphere was amazing. It was a one-off, but an experience I'll never forget.
Speaker 2.
Well, I got roped into the tug-of-war competition after meeting the fathers of other children at the same school as my kids. It was all they talked of for days beforehand, and I soon got into the spirit of things. We boasted about how fit we were and how no one stood a chance against us. There weren't many people there at first, but the school field soon filled up. The event had been well advertised. We found ourselves up against a team of big, burly firemen who just grinned at each other when they saw how unfit we were. I had imagined how proud my sons would be to see me win, but instead, they both walked away in disgust when our team fell over in the mud. At least I was able to see the funny side of things.
Speaker 3.
It was an awful experience. For starters, I would have expected the organisers to have at least heated the pool. It was like diving into the Arctic Ocean. It was my first swimming club competition, and definitely my last. No seats had been provided for the spectators, who were everywhere, even at the side of the pool, and there were so many competitors that we had trouble trying to find somewhere to change into our costumes. Once the races were over, some of the more competitive swimmers started arguing with the judges about finishing times. Fortunately, the judges paid no attention to them. But just the thought of those people telling lies to win a competition made me see red and basically spoilt everything for me. And to think I'd only entered the competition for the hell of it. So much for sportsmanship.
Speaker 4.
I love bowling, so I thought I could get in lots of practice by going to the all-night bowling alley. There were all sorts of people there, and the evening started really well. The lanes were well polished, which made it easier to do tricks like using spin. It was a great chance to hone my skills. I'd heard that they usually turned off the main lights at midnight and bowled in lanes lit by fairy lights. This time, though, it didn't happen, which was a bit of a letdown. Instead, all these professionals came out and gave a demonstration of how to get strike after strike. Although impressive to watch, it kind of put a damper on my plans.
Speaker 5.
I only did it because my brothers bet that I wouldn't. The training was quite expensive, so I didn't want to back out even though I was terrified. Anyway, I found myself on a small plane, which was quite amazing in itself, as I have a fear of heights. The instructor lined us up, and out we sprang one by one. Though I didn't admit it to my brothers, I spent the next 20 minutes with my eyes tightly shut, praying to every god in the universe. I was petrified. As soon as my feet touched the ground, I bent down and kissed it over and over again. Of course, my brothers now think I'm incredibly brave, which I feel a bit bad about. It's like I'm pretending to be something I'm not. Maybe I should just own up.
That's the end of part 4. That's the end of the test.